You were talking about the visit to Jack.
Oh, Jack, well, that's right. Trivial and irrelevant. No, I was probably in touch with Paul. I communicated with him fairly well.
It makes sense now, because he was, you already knew him before you went to Columbia, and
oh, yes.
I hadn't
made
that connection.
He had been, as I said, a faculty instructor here for a year. I had taken his course. We had talked about semicarbazone formation quite a bit, and talked quite a bit. So, yes, we were reasonably well acquainted, and well enough acquainted that when Jean and I were married in 1937, the Bartlett sent us a very nice wedding present, still preserved with great pleasure. Well, anyway, shall I go on to the University of Chicago?
Yes.
Well, when I got to the University of Chicago, I started doing several things. One was that paper on the amino acids, which didn't work out so well. One was the business of amine catalysis of the dealdolization of diastone alcohol, which, together with the explanation of this, is going by way of a shift base, which I published in an obscure journal where it was never seen. I consider really respectable chemistry.
That was the Journal of Organic Chemistry, or
was it? Then it is
okay.
An obscure now.
Yes, okay.
All right. It isn't obscure now, but it was an obscure journal then. Yeah. And at the same time, that first year at the University of Chicago, I did two other things. I gave a course in physical organic chemistry, which almost ended my career in chemistry. And I took the course in electricity and magnetism in the physics department, which I should have had maybe as an undergraduate, but was getting as a faculty member, but I needed it. And I didn't know how badly I needed it. But I took it.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt that the way I just wanted to learn biochemistry when I was at Columbia, I better learn some electricity and magnetism. So, wait a minute, what did I say just before that? Run the tape back and let's see.
Okay.
I gave the first course in physical organic chemistry that had been given at the University of Chicago. It's a new field. And I had a group of very bright students in the course. And they kept asking me questions I couldn't answer. And I kept writing Louis Hammett and saying, Louis, I'm in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked the following question, I don't know the answer. Can you help me? And I would get back letters from Louis saying, gee, that's a good question, isn't it? Didn't help me much either. Truth is, there wasn't much physical organic chemistry known then. And these bright people were asking me questions I had never thought and couldn't answer. Well, you know, it's all right if you have a bright student in your class who asks you a question you can't answer. And maybe it's all right if you have two. But if you have six, then you have to face the possibility that the students aren't so bright after all.
Mm-hmm.
And there is another explanation for your inability to answer these questions. Well, it turned out the University of Chicago had been pleased with my services and had raised my salary from $1,800 a year.
That was your initial salary?
Yes.
Okay.
To $2,100 a year. And on the strength of that vote of confidence on the part of the university and that salary, I picked up the long-distance telephone and phoned Jean and asked her to marry me.
Now, where was Jean at this time? She
Philadelphia.
Was, she was, okay.
And I just didn't see how I could resign from the University of Chicago and have no job and you know, I had this obligation to marry this girl. I couldn't back down. I didn't know what to do, so I didn't do anything and stayed. The what happened was there were a group of postdocs and graduate students at different years, all of whom came to this course because it was the first one in physical organic chemistry. And it included Ted Puck and Nathan Sugarman and Norman Davidson and Irv Cloakes and Herb Brown. At least those.
When looking back,
it was a rather extraordinary group of people.
I see.
And what?
It wasn't just the undergraduates who were asking you.
Oh, no, these were. This is a graduate. This is a graduate.
It wasn't. Okay.
It was a graduate school course, but it wasn't just.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't
okay.
just any graduate student who was asking these questions. I couldn't answer. It was quite an extraordinary collection of stars.
What a fine baptism that was for you.
But it really was tough. Well,
what kinds of things were you talking about? Do you have any idea?
I don't remember. My guess is that I was talking about the work of Hammett and Derup on superacidity, and the work of Ingold, certainly, on solvolysis, and but I don't remember. I don't have any notes from those days, and it's all faded from memory. I had a good friend then, who was a graduate student of Karach, named Ernest May. He and I were about the same age. He was an old graduate student. I was a young instructor. And he used to come into my office after each one of my lectures and slump down in the chair and look at me sadly. And he said, "You know, that was the worst lecture I've ever heard." I thought the lecture you gave last Wednesday was going to be the worst one, but gee. This one was much worse than that. And then he would tell me what I had done wrong. Be marvelous you get people to do that. It was extraordinarily important and helpful.
In his helping you with your lecturing and Senior helping you with your writing,
yes,
you received a marvelous education.
Yes, very good. Well, the next year was one of those great things. Kirkwood came to the University of Chicago. He had been an assistant professor at Cornell. He was lured away to be an associate professor at Chicago and went back to Cornell the year after as a full professor. So he was in Chicago 1 year.
Oh. Did you mention that he was... He was also here.
He had been at MIT, okay, and collaborated with Cohn. With Cohn. And I knew. I knew his work is an overstatement. I knew of his work. I knew sort of what his work was, especially this work on the activity coefficients of proteins. So when he came, I had been fussing with a paper of Ingold's. Ingold had a paper in the literature, and I wrote down the 1931 paper. And I read almost all of Ingold's papers, and it was a 1931 paper, and it was on electrostatic theory. And Ingold was trying to explain electrostatics on the basis of electrical saturation in the neighborhood of ions. I didn't understand that very well. It may have been, though I don't really remember, that one of the impetuses for my taking that course in Chicago in electricity and magnetism was this paper of Ingold's. Mm-hmm. Try to get some understanding. And I wanted to explain electrostatic effects in organic chemistry. And I didn't like Ingold's way of doing it at all. I didn't know how to do it. I knew the problem was there. I really knew that the solution was in Kirkwood's papers. But I couldn't work it through. I was just stymied. What is the word I want? Frustrated. So when Kirkwood came, it was a marvelous opportunity. I went to Kirkwood and I said, I'm sure this is in your papers. I can't get it out. This is this Ingold paper and so on. So he read the Ingold paper. I came back to him a day or two later and he said, yes, sure. We can work that out on the basis of an extension of this and this paper.
Now, the Bjarne paper had...
The Bjarne paper and the Eucken paper were both in the literature, and I knew them.
Okay.
And I took those to Kirkwood, as well as the Ingold paper. And, you know, I said, the Bjarne paper looks right to me, the Ingold paper doesn't look right to me, but there has to be something to do. You know the Eucken paper?
No, I don't.
In the Bjarne paper, Bjarne had looked at charge-charge interaction, and had used the dielectric constant of the salt. Eucken had written the corresponding formula for dipole charge interaction for, say, chloroacetic acid.
Okay.
And it used, instead, a dielectric constant of unity.
Right. I do know about that. So.
And I went into Kirkwood and said, look, you this works for this and this works for this, and you can't have both. It's inconsistent, and I don't think that what Ingold did is right, because if you're going to have electrical saturation, it should work better for the charges than for the dipoles, and it's the other way around, and this isn't right, and the solution is somewhere in your papers, I'm sure, but I don't understand. So he treated me sort of like an advanced postdoctoral fellow. I said, yes, indeed, I'm sure this is going to come out, and you take these two papers of mine and read them. Well, you know, today I don't think anyone would have the courage to do this sort of thing because everybody's in such a hurry. But I didn't know I was in a hurry then. There wasn't that spirit of hurry, and the University of Chicago had a very nice atmosphere. And so I went to try to read those papers. I couldn't read the papers. So I bought myself a book. I still have it on the shelf. On the Legendre functions. And... and went, where is that? Firelight text. And here it is. Fourier series and spherical harmonics. Copyright 1893. So, following the
okay, go ahead.
Tradition that I guess started in high school with learning trigonometry. I learned this mathematics. And after I'd learned this, I found I could read Kirkwood's papers. And I would guess that it was 2 months before I went back to Kirkwood and said, yes, indeed, I think I now am prepared to do this with you. And...
Must have thought you'd gotten lost.
Oh, no. I mean, in Chicago in those days, one saw each other, we talked.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he knew what I was doing.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe he thought I was slow, which... But... and then... We developed that electrostatic stuff together. And when we got the equations, they all had to be worked out, and they were... I worked out the numbers with a hand-cranked Monroe, not even an electrical one.
That was one of the questions I had. Who was sitting there cranking out those numbers?
And, you know, hour after hour, day after day, mm-hmm. building those tables. Mm-hmm. And then showing that that all this made sense.
And all the numbers you published were just a few distances, I remember.
Didn't we publish the tables? I don't know. I thought it was
maybe later on.
We published two papers. One where we solved the electrostatic equations for a sphere, and one for a prolate ellipsoid with the charges at the foci. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had a prolate ellipsoid and didn't put the charges at the foci, you got an infinite series of infinite series. You had to solve an infinite series for every point, mm-hmm. and then you had an infinite series anyway of those. Said it correctly.
Yes.
And so we didn't try to put them off the foci because I couldn't do that much calculating. Mm-hmm. Couldn't be done. That can be done today.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was done. And it was done quite recently, and I have the reference. It's kind of interesting to me that so little has progressed in that field till now. People, I think, are now going to do it better by an entirely different method. But it's been 40 years. Where the hell is that stuff?
So I'm thinking how nice it would have been had you had a computer.
Yes. This was done, of course, with a computer. And here we are. Aronson, Ehrenson, JACS 98, 7510, 1976. Now, there's a little bit of personal shame in connection with this that I guess I will recite to you, though I don't think it's relevant. In 1972, I got a paper to referee by a man named Edward Farrell and Job, which said that we had gotten some of our numbers wrong, that Kirkwood and I had gotten some of the numbers wrong. And I had done all the calculating, and I did not go back to put it on a computer and check it, which I should have done. And I just wrote to the editor of the Journal of Chemical Physics and said, gee whiz, you know, if I've done it wrong and this man has done it with the computer, I'll trust him and I've made a mistake. And you'd better publish it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turned out that we hadn't made a mistake. What had happened was the following. We had, in fact, carelessly published an equation where one of the terms had the wrong sign. And we had published an erratum immediately thereafter correcting it.
Mm-hmm.
And Aronson found the error himself. He didn't find the erratum. Mm-hmm. I called the erratum to his attention when I refereed his paper, and he was reasonably ungracious about it in the publication. But he had found the error himself. These other people had found neither the error nor the erratum. It didn't occur to me that they referenced the erratum. They referenced the erratum, but obviously hadn't read it.
So they just did the calculations with the wrong sign.
And the fact that that erroneous paper is in the Journal of Chemical Physics is, in a sense, my fault. What?
Your fault.
Yes. But the first real improvement on that, there was a paper by Sarmasakis some years after our work that did this same thing for the oblate ellipsoid, which is not a common... Well, could be. I mean, you could use that for benzenoid.
Mm-hmm.
Compounds. And then the next thing was Aronson doing this with a computer and moving the line, the allowing you to put the points anywhere you like on the central axis, because the computer can do an infinite series of infinite series.
Okay.
And I couldn't.
Right.
The question then arises as to the science involved in that work that Kirkwood and I did together. Mm-hmm. And how good was the science, and what did it contribute to organic chemistry, and why has it been so long and before anyone has improved it, which I don't think anyone has really done yet, but will soon. Well, everyone, I guess, thinks very highly of his own work. I think very highly of that work. It seems to me the first thing one wants to do is to establish a philosophical principle which is Paul's. Paul laid down the principle that one does quantitative experiments to establish qualitative principles. And it seems to me that that is an extremely important difference. That is a kind of perspective on science that keeps one from getting lost in detail. What the model that Kirkwood and I put forward did was to reconcile Bjerrum with Eucken and let one see why those two limiting approximations could both coexist in the same physical world. And that seems to me to have been a qualitative thing well worth doing with all that fancy mathematics.
Whalen does a marvelous job in explaining the importance of it, by the way, in his one of his books on advanced organic chemistry. I looked at that a few days ago.
So, are you sure I didn't write that section?
You may. I never thought of looking in the acknowledgments to see.
Chapter 11, whatever that is based upon a memorandum which was prepared for me by Professor Frank H. Rustin. So that's Freeland's rewrite
of
a memorandum I wrote him.
Okay.
How much of that is then Wheeland and how much is me?
You did a marvelous job of, of explaining the importance of that piece of work.
But there are two things to say about it in retrospect. One is the reason it's been so long in being substantially improved is that solutions are so difficult, and hydrogen-bonded liquids especially are so difficult, so that it has taken a long time before, it's just about now, I think, that people are getting ready to make big improvements. The second thing was a matter of luck, and it is a matter of luck that, in a way, that this approach of Ingold's was wrong, because one should have electrical saturation. And I don't know if you know the history of electrical saturation, but Debye wrote a nice paper on electrical saturation in which he showed how this would occur with increasing electric field. And published a paper, I can get you the reference, so I don't have it, showing how, if this is the distance from a charge, the dielectric constant would fall sharply because of electrical saturation. Maybe I made that curve a little steep. That's the sort of thing it was. And then a German whose name I've forgotten, once knew well, I'll go back and read up. I didn't do my homework thoroughly. Did some experiments in which he was able to get electrical fields enormously greater than those at which Debye had predicted breakdown. And there wasn't any electrical breakdown. There wasn't any saturation up to electrical breakdown. And it turned out that it took a much greater electric field. I guess I've done it wrong. I guess Debye's curve was this one, way out here. It took a much greater electric field than Debye had indicated to produce electrical saturation. On the other hand, when this German, whose name I've forgotten, used non-hydrogen bonding liquids, like ethyl ether and ethyl acetate, the Debye curve was followed exactly. And then Debye came along with another paper and said, oh, well, yes, I missed hydrogen bonding. So he put hydrogen bonding in it, and of course you put another parameter in, you can make it fit, and he made it fit, and it turned out that you had to go out quite a distance from the ion. So, just what I don't want. You had to come in extremely close to get the high fields that give you electrical saturation. And this is so close, maybe out here, about there to 3 angstroms, that you never get two things close enough together in water to have very much electrical saturation. Now, of course, in detail, that's got to be modified as one gives up a continuum and goes to real molecules with hydrogen bonds and so on. You can't have those continual molecules. But if electrical saturation had occurred at the large distances that Debye originally predicted, then the kind of treatment that Ingold was trying, perhaps not very well, but trying to make, would have been correct. And what Kirkwood and I were doing would have been wrong. But, in fact, electrical saturation doesn't occur that way. And it was known, actually, that it didn't occur, but that knowledge wasn't very deeply implanted in people. And I must confess that I don't think I knew it at the time, really. Maybe Kirkwood did.
So, it was...
And then, that was fun, and then very shortly thereafter I got Aaron Novick, a very good student, and we went off on that
on that business I told you about at lunch.
Novick's thesis wasn't published till 1943, but that was because of the war. And I don't know when he began, but
he also did the chromic acid oxidation.
He did the first chromic acid oxidation work, but we couldn't publish this.
Right.
We had to do something else.
Okay.
That was his second half of his thesis. The first half of his thesis was this thing where it begins, several years ago, Bergman advanced the hypothesis the amino acids of protein are arranged in a repeating pattern. And here's all this business on the iodination. I haven't reread this in a long time.
Well,
What was the name of the X-ray crystallographer again?
Rose C. L. Mooney, M-O-O-N-E-Y. It says here in the summary, Professor R. C. L. Mooney of the Sophie Newcomb College, New Orleans, Louisiana, who undertook the X-ray study, has not as yet found any evidence of the expected distances. This, however, does not necessarily prove the Bergman hypothesis, since there are a number of possible causes for failure of the method. These are discussed in the thesis.